There she is at a little table, playing with the little dishes, looking cute and innocent, looking like she wouldn't melt butter. She's that cool. Well, she can fool some people with that innocent look she can put on, put off whenever she wants to, but not me. Not even part way she can't fool me. Don't want to talk to nobody smart, huh? Like to talk to people she can fool, like a mama and Mrs. Breedlove and Mr. Emery.
Here's some Excelsior for you. You talk silly all the time. I know what you do with the Excelsior. You made a bed of Excelsior down the basement, behind that old furnace. And you sleep there, where nobody can see you.
I've been way behind the times heretofore. But now I got your number, miss. I've been hearing things about you that ain't nice. I've been hearing you beat up that poor little Claude Daigle boy in the woods, and it took all three of the Fern sisters to put you off him. I heard you run him off the wharf. He was that scared.
If you tell lies like that, you won't go to heaven when you die.
I heard plenty. I listen when people talk. Not like you, gab, gab, gabbling all the time, wondering nobody get a word in edgewise. That's why I know what people are saying. And you don't.
People tell lies all the time, but I think you tell them more than anybody else.
I know what you've done to that little boy when you got him out of that wharf. You better listen to me if you want to stay out of bad trouble.
What did I do if you know so much?
You pick up a stick, and you hit him with it. You hit him with it because he wouldn't give you that medal like you told him to. I thought I'd seen some mean little gals in my time, but you're the meanest.
Hello and welcome to Book vs. Movie. This is a podcast where we read books that have been adapted into movies, and then we try to decide which we like better, the book or the movie. I am Margot P. of ColoniaBook.com, and this is my good friend and co-host, Margot D. of Brooklyn Fit Chick.
Hi, everyone.
I'm very excited. We haven't done a redo in a while.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, so this will be fun. So for those of you who are new, yes, this is a podcast where we read books, and then we watch the movies that have been adapted from those books. Since we've been in this pandemic time, we've been doing a brand new episode every single week. And so that means sometimes we're using shorter literary sources. Although for the month of October, again, if you're new, maybe you don't know this, for the month of October, we like to do spooky books and movies or scary books and movies. And so today we're going to be doing a book and movie we did a while ago, a few years ago. But it is a good... It's a pretty scary movie. I forgot how scary it is. But we're going to be talking about The Bad Seed. But before we get to that, if you would like to interact with us or other listeners of this podcast, there are several places where you can do that on the internet.
Yes, you can definitely like our Facebook page, and we post all of the episodes there. If you want to get an even deeper dive, you can go into our Facebook group. You go to Book vs. Movie Podcast Group, and you ask to join. Other people offer suggestions there. What we ask when you're offering suggestions, by the way, is it has to be something that's pretty easy to get. It should be on Kindle or on the Libby app, which is our library app here in America. It also should be something easy to stream, something you should find. If it has to be like a VHS copy that's from 1978, you know, on eBay, we can't get it, then no, we can't do that. But anyway, just to keep that in mind, we're on Twitter at Book vs. Movie. Spell that out. Also on Instagram, Book vs. Movie. Just spell that out. We also have a basic old-timey email, bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you would like some stickers, we got a stack of stickers here, and we would drop them in the mail for you.
That's right. And if you really enjoy this podcast and you'd like to help keep us in books and movies, you can support us on Patreon.
Yes, we have a Patreon page, and what you do is you just type in P-A-T-R-E-O-N, look up Book vs. Movie Podcast. We are putting all of our episodes, we've been doing this for about 7 years now, from 2019 to previous to that. That's all going on to the Patreon wall, because for iTunes and a lot of different apps, they only go back 100 episodes and or 2 years. So we're just doing it, cutting it off at that. P-A-T-R-E-O-N, we have a couple of very affordable options. It helps keep us with books and movies. We're not getting rich from this. It just helps us keep the lights on, as they say, hosting costs and things like that. Thank you so much for all of you that do support us there. We really appreciate it. Also, quick note, there are a bunch of things there that are free, including old episodes. So if you hear one and you want us to redo it, maybe that's a thing to recommend to us.
Absolutely. Yeah. We haven't done a redo in some time, but today we are doing a book and movie that we did a few years ago in October. I'm sure it was in October. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, I still own this book. I didn't have any trouble getting it, although it is a very, very easy, both the book and the movie are super easy to find. You can probably get it from your local library. We're going to be talking about The Bad Seed.
I'm so excited about this. And I really went down the looking glass, through the looking glass, excuse me, down the rabbit hole about our author, William March, who's just so interesting. I can't wait to talk about him and this movie and this play. Everything, the book, everything.
You know, it's such a groundbreaking, the book, really. I mean, we say groundbreaking a lot on this podcast, but it truly is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just blew people's minds that you would have a serial killing
child,
little perfect little girl. She's the perfect 1950s little girl, and she's a serial killer. But it all came from the imagination of William March.
Yes, he was born William Edward Campbell in 1893, Mobile, Alabama, Alabama boy, grew up all over rural Alabama. His dad was an itinerant worker. He is one of 11 kids. He was the second to the oldest. His pen name is William March. He had to drop out. We've had this happen before with other authors. They had to drop out when they're young in order to support the family. He had to do that. He did eventually get his high school diploma when he was 20. He moved to New York City when he was pretty successful. He lived in Brooklyn. He worked at a law firm. He was saving up to go to college. He wanted to go to University of Alabama. He wanted to go back there, excuse me. And then it's 1917, the war happens, World War I happens. And he signed up.
He enlisted.
Enlisted.
He was in draft.
So he lands over in France. He gets injured right away, spends a summer in a hospital, and then still serving. He serves for 2 years. He gets the Croix de Guerre, the Navy top service medals in for bravery. He was extremely brave. But in 1918, he had actually killed a German soldier. He remembers the day and the time and everything, and it completely scarred him. We've talked about this before also about men coming back, men and women coming back from serving and having what we now call PTSD. But you were saying one time we were recording the show when you worked at a news station, you even just say PTS now. You don't even say PTSD.
Yeah, because it's so common. I mean, it's so you can't really call it a disorder when it is such a pervasive condition. Yeah, you know, I mean, and it would just change your life forever, an experience like that. And yet, you know, in his, what else could he have done in the scenario? And so, yeah, he consequently, although it was a fairly new phenomenon, he did have some psychological treatment.
Actively, when he came back to America and he came back to New York, and he was very successful working in business. He didn't start writing until the late 20s. He went to a psychiatrist, and very new for the time, by the way. It was considered pretty unusual. And he got really into psychoanalysis. And then we've also talked about this theme several times, mid-century America, psychoanalysis, psychology starts to enter into the arts. The artists start doing it first, and then it goes out to the burbs. But he was getting this help psychologically. He also lived and worked in Europe for a while. In England, he was getting deep psychotherapy. He starts writing about his experiences first in short story form, and he took the name William March because he was still working in the business world. And then he wrote a book called Company K in 1933, which is all about his experiences in World War I. And it was a very brutal account. And it's one of the first very realistic, brutal accounts of being in a war, not like, rah, rah, isn't this great to be a soldier? It's pretty damaging to a person. And he struggled. He struggled in New York. He made some money with his writing, and then his friends worried about him so much. He was so reclusive. He never, by the way, owned a TV or a radio or a car, never learned to drive. And he became this recluse, and his friends talked him into moving back to Mobile. And he did that for a few years, and then he moved to New Orleans. And eventually he wrote this book. He started in 1950, The Bad Seed, and he started telling his friends and family it's about this murderous girl and the psychology behind it. And they all told him, you're crazy. No one's going to read that. But he just kept doing it. Unfortunately, the book comes out in May of 1954. He has a heart attack in January or February of that year. gets sent home, and then he dies at home just a couple of weeks later. He was embarrassed about the book. He didn't think it was his best work. He would have no idea. But as Margot said, it's a huge hit. It sold a million copies that year. And by the end of the year, it was a play. This is just how popular it was.
It just captured the imagination. And I think on so many levels, like you were saying, that the whole interest in psychology, he kind of was just ahead of the wave of that enough that the play picks it up and really explores it in a way that affected, you know, the culture in itself. And yeah, just this notion of when we think of 1950s, you know, post-war United States, where, you know, during the war, women were working in factories, they were building bombs and planes and things, and then the war ends and they're like, okay, back to the kitchen, get your apron on. The role of and stereotypes of women is like really solidly enforced. So to explore that with the layer of the psychology, it just, I'm sure it must have just, I can't, you know, it's hard for us in a 21st century perspective to try to imagine like what that must have been like to read that for the first time when you didn't have, like, by the time you and I came along, there were several versions of The Bad Seed that were already out and was already something of a trope, but it was a brand new thing. Yeah. And it's, I haven't read his other works, but this work is really well written.
It certainly is. There was a documentary I saw, and it on YouTube, you can find it. He's a fantastic writer, but this is a story, and it's based, a woman's voice is the main voice, which is the mother. And then we have Rhoda, and then we have her daughter, and then we have her friends, mainly women in this story. There's Leroy and the brother, and the father shows up occasionally, but
it's really driven by the women. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You know, there's no talking about what his personal life was like. Did he have one even, any relationships or anything like that? But I mean, I would just say, like, his idea of women and how they speak and interact with each other, it's what I think a man would think a woman talks like and thinks like in 1950, which is what he was dealing with. I mean, that's,
yeah, which I mean, and I think it works. Even though, yes, it's, you read it and you're like, really? But I feel like it's self-aware.
Yes,
I guess is what I'm thinking. It is a self-aware, like, this is the 19, just like you said, the 1950s perception of how a woman would think this through and how she would react, and she would be worried about what people would think and all this kind of stuff. It's just so good. I love these characters. I think there's nobody in it that you, except for the mom. I mean, the mom, you really feel sorry for
yes.
her.
Yes.
You really connect
with
her.
Struggling. And you wonder if that's the William March, too. Did he struggle like that when he was trying to think through his problems?
It's not her fault. But anyway, it starts right away. I mean, we get right into it right away. Mm-hmm. You know, something is weird with this little girl. Like, to outward, he sets it up as basically she's the absolute 1950s ideal of a little girl. In the book, she's described as having brown hair, I think.
And they do in the other adaptations. I think the one way they try to distinguish themselves, because Patty McCormick with the blonde hair and the braids is so indelible.
Iconic. Yeah. But, you know, it starts so again, like Margot said, it became a play almost right away. The book was adapted into a play, was adapted into a movie in pretty short order. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it opens on the day of this school picnic. Mm-hmm. We know that Rhoda is a little odd. You know, she's strange. There's something weird about this kid. You know, she's very dressed up for a school picnic where she would be, you know, like running around, like catching frogs and stuff. And there's this mention of this penmanship medal that she did not get. And one of the things I thought was kind of interesting about that little detail, because it's this driving force, is this medal, this penmanship for penmanship. I mean, first of all, like, can we set the bar any lower?
Supposedly it's based on his sister Margaret won one.
I read somewhere that although he wasn't like open about, I mean, he wrote about his experiences in the war and all that, he carried his medals with him everywhere he went, William March. He always had his medals on him. So I think it's so interesting that this thing about the medal is so important in this story. And right away, she has a disproportionate response of, you know, a little overblown to not getting the penmanship medal. And in the book, actually, they even go as far as to say, like, well, the reason that the boy got it, what's his name? Daigle?
Claude.
That the reason the little boy got it and she didn't was because it was for the most improved penmanship, and her penmanship was already perfect, of course. And so why would she get a medal for improved penmanship? But anyway, the fact that it was a medal and she didn't get it, and she's not letting it go in a way that right away you're like, what is going on with this kid? You were never going to get this medal.
Well, she's somebody that she's such a almost like a robot kid. Like, she acts and performs like a child. Like Vicky, remember that show in the 80s? The girl, the
small wonder.
Rhoda's kind of like that. She just, like you said, she has like the perfect hair, the perfect dresses. It's almost like early 20th century that she dresses like not mid-century. And everything is perfect, and everything is like, oh, daddy, if you give me a basket of kisses, I'll give you a basket of hugs. And her relationship with her dad is very, you know, weird. But he's out of the picture on business in the book. I think he just has to go someplace like a Germany or whatever. And so the mom, and they don't really say where it takes place in the book, but he wrote it in Mobile, and they think that's where he was thinking of. It would make sense. I mean, that's where you have like you would chase frogs and have penmanship.
Yeah, it's not, I don't think he outright says, but yeah. And in the book, I don't think her father is in the military in the book. I think the father is just on business, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on business. He's going to Europe. And so he and the wife are just going to communicate via letters, which is what people did at the time. Not everybody had a phone. He misses Rhoda. Mota's going to miss him. And so it's just Christine Penmark is her name, Rhoda. And then she has friends named Monica Breedlove. I mean, some of these names are just like on the nose.
They're fun. Yeah. Yeah. Monica Breedlove, the nosy landlady. Aunt Monica.
Yes. Who adores Rhoda and just worships that kid. And we have this man named Leroy Jessup, and that's such a Southern name. He's the handyman. He's living on the property. They're at this apartment complex. There's something off about him. He's kind of rude and crude, but he recognizes like a kinship almost with Rhoda. Like, he understands there's something up with Rhoda and knows it's evil. He knows it's bad.
Yeah. He also, I mean, an interesting character. He also has kind of out of proportion responses to things, reactions to things. You also, like, when he comes on the scene, you're like, what's this guy is not a regular guy. He has this weird, like, affinity with this creepy little girl. It's so weird. It's so, like, disturbing. It, you know, just right off the bat, you're like, I don't like this.
But he has these conversations with her, and she's like, oh, you're just a silly old man. Go away. Pshoo. And he has this habit just to set the scene, but he has this habit of having his lunch, and then he goes in the basement and takes a nap. Like, that's kind of like a daily routine. And what happens is, spoiler, by the way, in case this is your first time listening, we do spoil the details. Claude dies at the picnic. He drowns. He falls off the pier. And they're kind of like, did he jump in? Did he fall in? What happened? No one's quite sure. Rhoda comes home all upset. All the parents are super upset. And then Then there's wondering, like, there's marks on his face, and they can't quite figure out what the marks are. And it's Leroy who decides, like, oh, I think, you know, she used to wear tap shoes around everywhere.
Yeah, she had little metal, I forget what they're called. They have a name. But, you know, little, like tap shoes have, like little metal things to protect her shoes, cleats, yeah, to protect her shoes. She would tap around on them because they make a noise, you know, they're metal. And yeah, and he's the one that kind of puts it together because he assumes the worst about her, rightfully so, because she's the worst.
Yes.
But yeah, so the little boy, it's so sad, like this little boy who all he did was improve his penmanship. And for that, like, he pays with his life. So yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, it's a big tragedy for the school, and it's a big deal. And they're trying to figure out what happened. And they know that Rhoda was the last one to see him alive because they were seen together. But Rhoda's not talking. You know, she's an adept liar. We know that she's a very good liar, pretty much right off the bat again. So the landlady, Monica Breedlove, is a very fun character. She's, you know, extremely nosy. We get this backstory that she went for psychoanalysis, which again, like Margot said, was a very unusual thing to do. And so she goes to the story is like she goes and gets psychoanalysis and decides to get a divorce as a result of her psychoanalysis. And, you know, she's supposed to be this like evolved, you know, pseudo intellectual. And yet she is completely fleeced by Rhoda. She buys every single lie that this child is spewing at her. And she spoils Rhoda rotten, you know, much more than the parents do. She has a locket that she gives to Rhoda, right? That's what happens. She gives Rhoda this locket, and the locket has the landlady. It's from when she was a little girl. It's got her birthstone, and she tells Rhoda, well, I'll change it for your birthstone. And she's like, well, can I have both?
We get a couple of stories about Rhoda in that she, one time that she had a dog and then the dog got annoying to her. It was a puppy.
Oh, yeah. And so this is not in the movie.
No, thank God. Basically, you'll just say it's just she gets rid of the puppy. And then there was an older lady that lived with them in the building, by the way. And then she and Rhoda became friends, and Rhoda liked one of her, what are they called?
A snow globe?
Yes. So she sees a snow globe and the woman says, oh, you know, when I die, I'll leave this to you. And then all of a sudden, pretty soon after that, she dies. And so most of this novel is Christine going through her head like, huh, there was the dog and then the dog was in her arms and then the dog's gone. Then there was this older lady and then she promised her a thing and now she's gone. And then she had a problem with Claude and now he's dead. I wonder if this all is because she's a sociopath with no compassion and she's terrible. And then Christine decides, and she's writing all these notes to her husband, all these letters, excuse me, to her husband.
Yeah, which is really cool in the book. It's not a thing that's really in the book play or the movie so much, but that is really, yeah, in the book you read these letters and she's trying to like figure out how to communicate this to her husband. Very interesting. I really like that whole part of the book.
She's trying to reach out to him, but she doesn't send them because she's so scared to send them because she's so scared of what could possibly be wrong. So a big part of the book actually, and it takes place over months and months, like a whole summer, I believe, but she's following Rhoda around to make sure she doesn't kill anybody. They go to the movies, they get ice creams together. Like that's really her motivation. And she's not allowed to go back to the school in the fall because the principal's like, oh, hell no, this is not going to happen. And Christine is sort of like, what do I do? And then Christine kind of figures out that she was adopted as a child. And it turns out it's very convoluted, but she was.
Her father is a famous, Christine's father is a famous journalist, mm-hmm. right? Like famous. She says when she's talking to Monica, who's like the pseudo psychoanalyst, who's like, Monica's like, for funsies, like, let's poke around in your brain, Christine, see what's there kind of thing.
I can handle it.
And Christine, you know, at one point she says like, oh, I've always had this feeling like I was adopted. And Monica's like, oh, that, everybody has that. But later she brings it up to her father and he's like, oh, why do you think that? And so she shares that she had this recurring dream where she was running from somebody and they were calling her. Anyway, so it turns out, yeah, she'd been adopted by her father and who she thought was her mother. And they adopted her because she was the abandoned child of like the most notorious serial killer in American history, that he was reporting on the story. This serial killer ran away and was never caught and left behind one of her children. It was Christine. And so since she didn't have anybody to go to, he adopted her. And so it's this whole exploration of, could you just be born bad? Could you just be a bad seed? Or is it Christine's fault? You know, is it something that she's doing that is causing her child to be a sociopathic murderess? So it is really just a fascinating exploration of gender roles in the 1950s, pop psychology, trauma, generational trauma. It's just really, really interesting.
Yeah, and it's only like 200 pages. It's a really quick
read. It's not long.
Yeah, no. You could read it in one fell swoop. In the end of the story in the book, Christine gives her daughter sleeping pills.
Yeah, she decides, okay, biggest difference between book and movie is really the end. A lot of it is the same. Totally different end. Again, spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. In the book, Christine comes to the conclusion that, like, this child has no conscience and she's going to get stopped. Either she's going to get stopped by me or law enforcement, which could be super bad, or alternatively, she's going to keep on killing people. Mm-hmm. And that can't happen. So, you know, what do I do? Because I love her. She's my daughter. But I can't, because I love her, I can't let her, like, what are they going to do with the kid killer?
What do you do? We don't know what to do now.
No.
Yeah. They don't know what to do. So she gives her daughter these sleeping pills, which is Monica Breedlove gave her the sleeping pills because she's not sleeping and she's lost a ton of weight and she's really anxious. And then she gives them to her daughter, who takes them right away. And then she takes a gun and shoots herself in the head. And the husband...
Christine does.
And the neighbors hear it. And so they immediately hear, because it's a gunshot.
Because it's a gun.
And you're in an apartment. You're not out in the woods. I mean, you know, pretty obvious. They call an ambulance. They come and get her. They take her to the hospital. And her daughter, Christine, they're waiting for the father to show up. And the father shows up and he's completely upset, of course. But they basically pump her stomach, Rhoda's stomach, and she's going to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, and the mom, Christine, before all of this, she burns all the letters that she'd been writing to her husband. So all the evidence against Rhoda up in smoke, literally up in smoke. So we're at the end of the story. Does Christine die?
Yes.
She does, right? Mm-hmm. So she doesn't make it, but Rhoda, who's been saved by the neighbors, who again are completely fleeced by her, she's just going to keep on living her Rhoda life.
Rhoda's got a Rhoda. So that's the end of the story. It becomes it becomes a play right away in London and in New York. Does very well. Critics love it. It's pretty similar to the book. They have all these great actors that are in it, and it becomes this film that immediately gets sold to Warner Brothers. Let me play the trailer first. It's a little long, but it gives you a good overview of like what the mood is of this.
She might get kind of lonesome when that soldier boy has gone.
I wish she were mine. Every time I look at her, I wish I had just such a little girl.
This has been a terrible tragedy for Mrs. Daigle as she's lost her only child.
That know-it-all Monica Breedlove. I don't think nobody knows anything but her.
He has the mind of an 8-year-old, but he's managed to produce a family, so I keep him on.
Give me those shoes back.
Oh, no, I got them shoes hid where nobody but me can find them.
Better give me those shoes. They're mine. Give them back to me.
I believe you did it.
What'll you give me if I give you a basket of kisses?
I'll give you a basket of hugs.
I'll miss your hugs.
Well, I'm not letting the slightest degree. Rhoda knows more than she's told. If you don't mind me being presumptuous. I had a long talk with that guard since I saw you last. And that was a long, interesting conversation. He said he saw Rhoda on the pier just before Claude was found among the pilings. She knows something, all right.
Did you have anything? I don't care how small it was. Did you have anything to do with the way Claude got drowned?
What makes you ask that, Mother?
Now look me in the eye and tell me the truth, because I must know.
No, Mother, I didn't.
You're not going back to the Fern School next year. They don't want you anymore.
Okay.
I'm going to call Miss Fern and have her come over here.
You think I lied to her?
You did lie to her.
But not to you, Mother, not to you.
You know something? Miss Fern dyes her hair.
And Rhoda's a sweet, perfectly sound little girl.
Is she, Father, is she?
Run, Daddy! Next to Daddy, you lift me up best. Why do you look at me?
I just want to see your face.
Our director is Mervyn LeRoy, and the movie stars, which is really unusual for what we've done in the past, is almost everybody that was in the Broadway show is in this movie, which doesn't always happen.
No, it happened, like we talked about Streetcar. Mm-hmm. Although that wasn't like Jessica Tandy was Blanche, but apart from that, it was pretty much everybody that was in the stage play. Same thing here. I think the dad is different. But otherwise, I think everybody, almost everybody is the same actor who portrayed the role in the stage play, which I think gives the whole thing just such an authenticity, because each actor, especially Patty McCormick, who we'll talk about in a second, but each actor so understands that role and has inhabited it for a long time. You just, I mean, and it's a crazy story. I mean, it's... Again, it was something that would have been completely implausible to the contemporary audience. And yet, because these actors are so like enmeshed in these roles, they really sell it just immediately.
They did over 300 performances of it, on Broadway. Patty McCormick was 12 years old when she did this. And to think like how great of an actor she is.
It's phenomenal. It's just jaw-droppingly good. So good.
She was a working actor as a kid, and she was on a show called Mama. And I think it's like, I was looking at this another thing. I went down YouTube and saw these old things.
Well, she was also famously on The Ropers. Remember her on The Ropers?
No.
Oh, yeah. So Three's Company had a spinoff called The Ropers. The Ropers, they're the landlady and landlord out of the Three's Company building, and they buy a townhome in a she development where they brush up against these like more upper crust neighbors who don't like them. And the neighbors are Jeffrey Tambor, and his wife is played by Patty McCormick.
Well, when she was a kid in 1954, 55, when they had this play come out, she would, That's My Mama, or is it called, that's another whole other show, Mama.
That's a whole other show. I think it's just called Mama. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like they were Swedish or Norwegian, and they came to America. I couldn't believe this. And this was like the number one show, and it's like nothing happens. I mean, it's so funny to look at things.
It's like, what will we have for Sunday dinner?
Yes. Dick Van Patten's in there. Dickie Van Patten. He looks like he's 12. I mean, it's like, oh my God. But she would do this on a Friday, and CBS studios are on like 10th Avenue in the 50s. She'd get in a cab, change her outfit, put on the wig, run on stage like 8:40 p.m. Boom. She would hit her mark on Friday nights every night, because that's when they would shoot that show.
Wow. What? Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And she's so good. And what's so wonderful is, I'm so glad they didn't recast this role, because that experience, because, you know, she did that role for hundreds of performances, she knew every single beat, like every single moment that the audience would gasp or laugh, or, you know, she knew that all so well. And she knows how to play all those moments where we see her face, but nobody else nobody else in the scene sees her face, only the audience, you know. Oh, it's so good.
It's very similar plot. Once again, it's Henry Jones who plays Leroy Jessup, and good God, is he creepy as he in the story in this movie? Oh my God, the chills.
The scene where he tells her about the little teeny electric chair. That was the scene that gave me nightmares when I was a kid. He's in everything, by the way. He's a character actor. He's got over 100 television appearances.
Easily.
So many film appearances. He's all over the place. Again, he played the role on the stage. And the character, it's funny because Patty McCormick's character in the movie, Patty McCormick's character is younger than she is. So she's playing younger. He's playing somebody older than he is. So, but anyway, all those scenes with the two of them they're brilliant and so scary. I think they're the scariest parts of this whole movie.
It's chilling. Because he constantly goes that zit, zit, zit sound of her to her. And then he comes up to her one day and goes, what really happened with that boy Claude, by the way? You used to walk around with tap shoes. What if you were the one who hit him in the face with a tap shoe? And then she crumbles. We forgot to mention this. So this is going back and forth. And he's just kind of telling, like, I got something on you now. And from now on.
He's just teasing her.
Yeah.
He's just a weirdo.
He's so gross.
He's just this weirdo. And he's messing with this kid. I mean, really. And inadvertently, completely inadvertently stumbles across the fact that she is a serial killer and how she did it. But completely by accident. Yeah, he's just stabbing around trying to mess with her.
And he had enough self-awareness to know, like, oh, boy, I probably shouldn't have given away my cards. And he's like, oh, no, I'm not going to say anything about it. In the movie, I don't know how they did this on stage, but in the movie, and it's so chilling, too. He goes to take his nap, and she basically lights his bed on fire. The next thing you know, you're here, and it's very, all this cacophonous sound, glingity, glingity, and a blankety, 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 and then he's screaming, and he's just screaming in pain. And this man is dying and just burning to death in the vestibule area, whatever you want to call that, where apartment building, and Christine can hear it, and everybody can hear it, and they're like, what do? We call the cops? Like, how do we handle this? And that also is super chilling, because Rhoda's just...
And she's playing the piano.
Around. Yeah, Claire de Lune.
She's, like, playing the piano.
No, Reg, back here.
Maybe I'm remembering this wrong, but I kind of remember that I read the play when we did this last time. I think I read the book and the play. I don't know why I think that. But I sort of remember that in the play, it's off stage. So same thing, like you hear him screaming and all of that, but and you see Christine reacting. It's like in the movie. I think it's very much like it is in the movie, as I recall.
Yeah. Nancy Kelly is great. I think... Some people criticize it for being a little over the top.
I mean, it's about a kid serial killer. What do you want?
I mean, she's trying to speak, you know, versus what's written on page and what she's thinking. You know, she's trying to get that out. But there's scenes where, you know, she is having lunch or she's having, you know, drinks with the Monica Breedlove and the other men coming over. And they just casually just start talking about murder stories, like my favorite murder.
Like you do.
Like one does, like from 70 years ago. It's incredible.
Oh,
Oh, yes, Mrs. Allison was a quite definite personality. She did away with 9 patients for their life insurance with almost as many different poisons. But you read about her in the papers, didn't you, Mrs. Penmark?
Oh, only hastily, I must say. I'm afraid I shy away from reading about such things.
Now, that's an interesting psychic block. Why would Christine dislike reading about murders?
I don't know. I just have an aversion to violence of any kind. I even hate the revolver Kenneth keeps locked in the house.
Oh, do you dislike the revolver more than the poison?
Ooh, I just hate them both.
Maybe if you try saying the first thing that comes into your mind, we can get at the root anxiety. Just say it, no matter how silly it seems to you. Tell your story, Reggie, and Christine will associate.
Oh, nonsense.
What do you mean, associate?
Just speak up, because any idea that comes into your mind will be an associated idea.
Oh.
Well, they finally caught on to Mrs. Allison when she poisoned her 80-year-old father with arsenic in his buttermilk.
And they're laughing about it, but then she kind of pokes around with Christine, and then Christine remembers, I think I was adopted. I think I'm like the daughter of somebody really famous for being a killer. Her dad comes home to visit, and he loves Rhoda, but he kind of says, he goes, oh no, Rhoda's fine. Don't worry about Rhoda. You didn't, nothing, because she's worried. Nature versus nurture. Did Rhoda inherit
exactly
what happened to me? How did I turn out great? Well, because my dad is so awesome. So maybe I'm not good enough mother. That's why that's right. And it's also psychology. If it's not one thing, it's your mother. That's right.
I thought one of the things I hadn't noticed until I watched it this time is the scene with her dad. So her dad comes over to visit. She asks him to visit because she's worried. She wants to get to the bottom of this. Christine does. And her dad shows up. And and that other psychologist guy is there, the other famous guy. And the dad asks for a drink, asks Christine to fix him a drink. And Christine fixes him a cocktail. And then they get into talking about she's under the guise. She said that she's writing a story. She's going to write a story about a kid killer. And is that such a thing? Could there be such a thing? And she wanted to ask him because he knows about serial killers, as he's written about them and the yada, yada. That's her little ruse. And so he kind of goes on about he doesn't believe that there's such a thing as a bad seed, that, you couldn't have a kid killer. Anyway, so he has this little like mini monologue. And then he's like, and I need a refill of my drink. It's a minute and a half after she served him. It has been 90 seconds. And then, 3 minutes later, if that, he wants another drink. He pours himself a third drink. He has 3 massive highballs in under 5 minutes.
It's Mad Men time. He basically gives her the okay symbol of no, she's fine. Don't worry about it. And then we wrote it. Just like in the play and in the book, Christine is questioning Rhoda. It's a shorter time period. It's not as drawn out as
it's condensed. Yes. There's because again, it's a movie, but also the play. The play does the same thing. So in the movie, the dad is in the military. Mm-hmm. So he's in Washington, D.C. There's talk of a war. I don't know if they mean the Korean War. I'm not sure what war we're supposed to be talking about. It must be Korea. That's not in the book at all. And yeah, things happen a little bit faster. The woman that plays Claude Daigle's mom.
Okay, Eileen Hecker. She was in the original play.
Another big character actress you've seen all over the place.
We're going to talk about one day. It's the Goldie Hawn movie with Diane Keaton and Bette Midler.
First Wives Club.
We were going to talk about that. The book is well over 400 pages, so we're going to have to put that off for just a little bit. But Eileen Hecker plays the grandmother in that, so I love her in this. But she originated the role on Broadway, so she's Claude's mother, shows up drunk as a skunk because her life is shattered. Her son was just drowned, and nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows who did it or why or what's going on. And she comes over, and she starts talking because she's like, Rhoda, you talked to him last. Can you please tell me what happened? Like anybody would do, probably.
Yeah, she's not suspecting the child.
No.
She just is desperate to know what happened to her son. It's just, she has two scenes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The dialogue is not easy dialogue. And there were so many ways, like she could have been hysterical. She could have been throwing things. She could have been a crumpled, weepy mess. But the way that she plays it is, I'm in awe every time I see it.
Yeah. Rhoda doesn't admit to anything, but Christine realizes, okay, this kid's a total mess. And she wants her husband to come back. Her husband comes back. Give me a basket of hugs and the kisses and blah, blah, blah. In the story, because at the time, what happened in Hollywood was called the Hays Code. One of those things that you couldn't do was let the killer get away with a thing. The bad person couldn't like come out triumphant. So there's a lot of movies kind of ruined because of that.
Indeed. Yes. Yeah. So we can't have the ending, which is the very chilling ending that the original source material has, where the mom dies and the daughter lives on to kill again, you know, being raised by people who totally buy her line. Yeah. So how do we deal with that now?
And the way they deal with it is the parents are so... Christine overdoses. She's in the hospital. Christine's in the hospital. The dad's home. And Rhoda realizes that I think like Claude had something on him, like a locket or something, some kind of jewelry.
Oh, I remember. It's weird. Again, this is all contrived for the purposes of the Hays Code. So in the last confrontation between Rhoda and her mom, Rhoda's like, well, now that the one guy who knew I killed this boy is out of the way, mm-hmm. I can have the medal, right? About that medal. And the mom is like, she says, look, I took the medal. I went over to the dock where you killed that kid and I threw it in the water. And Rhoda's like, oh, okay. And so just like in the book, the mom doses her daughter, shoots herself. Husband comes back. Mom's in the hospital. And we find out that the mom's in the hospital. We're not sure if she's going to live or not. She's conscious. She's speaking, but she's really not okay. And Rhoda, we at first think we're told she's been given a lethal dose of sleeping pills. And then somebody says, oh, well, fortunately we were able to pump her stomach, and she comes skipping down the hall of the hospital. We go through all this rigmarole. And so she goes home. She goes home with her dad, back to that apartment. Dad's having a fine time sleeping in the room where his wife tried to blow her brains out. That's not a problem. Like, none of this is in the book. None of it. So he puts Rhoda to bed. They are going to sleep. Mom's in the hospital. We don't know if she's going to live or not. It's nighttime. Rhoda puts on a slicker. It's raining. She puts on her rain boots and her slicker and a little rain hat, little perfect little rain hat. And she goes out. And we're like, what? What is this child doing? And turns out she's going out to that dock because it's all about the metal. She's going to get that medal. There she is out on the dock. And I just thought it was interesting because we can't have it be the mom, the one that takes her out. Right. So it has to be God,
Mother Nature,
Mother Nature. So she's out there on the dock and she gets struck by lightning in the end. And then we have everybody come out like, oh, it was just like, it was just for fun, just to play. Here we are. And that whole thing with her being spanked at the end, it's so weird.
When they did the play, that's what they had to do because people were so freaked out by this. Once again, this is years before true crime becomes a thing at all.
This is true. It was not a thing. It was not a, yeah. And I can imagine being in the stage audience and being kind of shook. Yeah. I get that.
And that happens in Broadway shows or in theater. I mean, depending on the show, when the people come out and...
It's a thing you do. You have the curtain call.
You have the curtain
call. You expect that in a theater. You don't expect that in a movie theater. That's not a thing you do.
One moment, please. And now, ladies and gentlemen, our wonderful cast. Paige Clark as Tasker. Mr. Jess White as Emery. Miss Joan Croydon as Miss Fern. Mr. Bill Hopper as Kenneth Penmark. Mr. Paul Fix as Richard Bravo. Mr. Henry Jones as Leroy. Miss Evelyn Varden as Monica. Miss Eileen Heckert as Mrs. Daigle. Miss Patty McCormick as Rhoda. And Miss Nancy Kelly as Christine Penmark.
That is for you.
You want to maintain a bit of the mystery of like what happened. But in this movie, because we kind of prove doesn't get away with it. But then on top of that, they're all just actors. Please don't be upset. This is fiction. And then, you know, they introduce them one by one. And then she spanks her at the end, which is what, you know, they did on Broadway every night just to make the audience go, oh, ha, 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 and then go home. Like they just have to figure it out. It does extremely well. Nancy Kelly, Eileen Heckert, and Patty McCormick were all nominated for Oscars.
They were all phenomenal.
Yeah.
They are all phenomenal. Again, it's a story driven by women. Leroy is a great role. But it's definitely a supporting role. And then the dad, you know, both Rhoda's dad and Christine's dad, very much like secondary, tertiary. They're just there to kind of validate what the women are doing. And all three of them. Yeah, the mom especially. Like this time I was really watching the woman who plays Christine, the mom.
Nancy Kelly.
Yeah, because again, and also the same thing with like the Claude Daigle mother role, like the dialogue is not fabulous. I mean, it's very expositional for both of them, you know. And again, there's lots of ways they could have played those roles, but I think both of them in particular, the way that they did it, like the way that the mom's like devolution of like this, the slowly putting the pieces together is so believable. I mean, I really feel like, you know, when she starts to really come apart at the seams, you're like, yeah, what is this? What is she going to do? What are you going to do, lady? Because this is your kid. And yet, you know, you can't, you know, you're a decent person. You can't let this go on. Blown away by their performances. Really, every time I watch it, I'm more impressed.
Yeah. It's pretty great. I mean, so book versus movie, which did you like? Or which one?
That's a toughie. Because
the book,
right? Is super good. And there's a lot of really interesting touches in the book that just for time are not in the play or the movie. But I mean, I got to give it to the movie because Patty McCormick, mm-hmm. You know, you can't, that's the other thing is, I can't read that book and not picture Patty McCormick. You know, even though the Rhoda that's being described in the book doesn't look anything like Patty McCormick, is kind of different than the way that she's playing that role even. She is Rhoda Penmark. She just is.
I think you could also make the argument that, you know, at that time in the 50s, late 50s, you know, mid 50s to the 60s, it's like the Hitchcock era of like icy blondes. And she's one of them.
Yeah, she really is. Yeah. It's, again, every time I see it, I'm more impressed. Every time. It never gets old. It's still like, it still gives me goosebumps. Mm-hmm. There are still moments that I just like, okay, I need to just pause this for a minute. And it's not even on screen. When Leroy is dying, it's, you know, again, you don't see anything. You're hearing him. And you're seeing Christine's reaction as she is looking out the window and seeing it. And it's so disturbing. Ugh. It's really something. It's very impressive. I think the whole thing, and I think they adapted it so well in keeping the spirit of it. Keeping the spirit of the theater production of it. They could have added a lot more locations or other characters. I think it's commendable that they didn't, that they really kept it to the main people who are in that book and in that play. I think all the way around, pretty really solid, really great.
Yeah, this was really fun to do.
What did you think? You didn't say book or movie.
Oh, I'm sorry, movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I loved reading it again.
Me too. It's a super great read. If you love this movie, you will really love this book. Very well written. I don't know why he had like feelings about it. Mr. March, I think he did a great job.
He wrote a lot about war before this and a lot about the South specifically. It was like, listening to some documentaries and stuff, and just like he tried to get away from the South and the war, but he never could ultimately. And I think he had his demons, and I think maybe he was scared to put that out there. I don't know. He's very impressive. I mean, he's very, very interesting. And so, yeah, I'm going to say the movie too. We had an interesting idea for November.
Yes, a listener suggestion. We love those.
We love those. Exactly. Please send us your suggestions. So we're going to do Disney in November. And I was thinking maybe we start with Sleeping Beauty. The book is very available. It's Charles Barrow. It's like 1843 or something. Easy to get on Libby, 40 pages. And the movie is available. It's one of the first Disney films. That one always terrified me too, to be honest, when I was a kid.
You know what? I was going to say, like, that one, Snow White, I could handle Snow White. Sleeping Beauty, man. Sleeping Beauty scared me so much that as a kid, because I'm from California. From Southern California. As a kid, I was kind of afraid to go in the castle at Disneyland. Because that's people, although I think it's Sleeping Beauty's castle. People call it Cinderella's castle. I think it's Sleeping Beauty's castle. Anyway, the castle scared me because of Sleeping Beauty. That's the point. That one I found super, super scary as a kid. It was not one that I was like asking to see again and again. So yes, I'm excited to do this one.
Awesome. So please follow us on all the things social media wise. Please send us your suggestions. It could be a play. It could be a magazine article, song, short story, novella. Please let us know or check out our Patreon page, like a lot, for the older early episodes. Maybe there's one you think we should redo. That's always commendable. Please send that all along to us. Our email is Her email is bookversusmoviepodcast@gmail.com. Once again, we do have stickers. If you would like some stickers, we're happy to drop them in the mail for you. And Margo, where can they find you?
You can find me online at coloniabook.com, and all of my social media callouts are at She's Not Your Mama. And where can they find you?
You can find me at Brooklyn Fitchick for Twitter and Instagram, and my site is brooklynfitchick.com. Thank you so much, everyone, for being with us through our spooky October films, and we will be back soon with Disney in November. Thank you so much for listening to the Book Versus Movie podcast. We are a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. You can find more podcasts you will love at frolic.media/podcasts. We follow the hashtags LadyPodSquad and PotterFamily. If you want to support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, go to PATREON, and look for Book Versus Movie Podcast. We have a basic Facebook page, but we also have a private Facebook group. Go to Facebook and type in Book VS Movie Podcast Group if you want to join that. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Book Versus Movie. Spell all those words out. If you'd like to send us an email, it's Book Versus Movie Podcast, spell that all out, @gmail.com. You can follow Margot D. at Brooklyn Fitchick on social media, and Margot P. at She's Nacho Mama. Thanks so much again for checking out our show, and we'll be back soon with a new episode. Mm-hmm.